Hello and welcome to the Conkers Corner podcast. My name is Peter Higgins. You can find me at Conkers3 on Twitter. And today I'm speaking with Phil J. Oakley. You can find him on Twitter at Phil J. Oakley. And he's the associate editor of the Investors Chronicle, the writer of the Alpha Report, the author of How to Pick Quality Shares, a fantastic book which I recommend anyone interested in investing should buy. And he's also an award-winning writer as well. I think Phil won't want to talk about it, but I'll mention it here. He won the Journalist of the Year with three articles last year. Well, this year, in fact, sorry, for 2020. One was the quality without growth is a bad mix, and back to basics, and should investors avoid acquisitive companies? And we can talk about that a bit later on, Phil. But how are you doing, mate?
I am very well, thanks, Pete.
Good, good, good. Now, it's been a very, very interesting year, Phil. Probably one of the most volatile that investors have had for some time, especially the newbies. And when I say newbies, you and I probably will say that most newbies are investors that have only been investing in stocks, shares and funds probably about for less than 5 years, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair description. We're always learning in this. So, you know, even if you've been doing it 20 years, doesn't mean you're going to get it right. But yes.
Absolutely. And that's exactly my sort of view on things, in that every day is a school day when it comes to investing, as we've seen with regards to what's going on in the markets today. I'll just note that it's 11 o'clock in the morning. It's the 21st of December. And Phil and I are going to talk about the markets. Phil, I want to start with just a roundup from you, really, in a sense of where we were back in January of 2020 and what the year has developed, how the year has developed from then on. We've had a 52-week high of 7,674 on the FTSE 100. We're at a low of 4,993 back in March of this year. And today we're there or thereabouts at 6,360. So we are the fastest drops and one of the fastest rises, but we've not gone back to 52-week high. What are your thoughts on it all?
I think it's been a very valuable year for investors, because almost anything that could happen has happened, and I think that you learn a lot when things are bad. I think you find that companies are a lot more open, a lot more honest with what they say when things are bad. And these are the sort of things that you need to pay attention to when you're researching companies, and bear them in mind as you go forward. But in terms of the year, I mean, if we look at where we were a year ago, I think most people, most commentators, most investors were fairly relaxed, fairly happy with how things were. I think they could have looked at the stock markets, both in Britain and particularly over in America, and thought, okay, they're not cheap, but they're not expensive. The economies, the backdrop of the consumer, the health of the household, you could have had concerns about that, as you've had for the last, well, ever since the financial crisis, really. But you thought somehow it's muddling through and it'll probably be a steady year. And it's proven to be anything but steady. But I have been really shocked, really taken aback by not the event, not the coronavirus and the lockdowns, but generally how hell-bent particularly the Federal Reserve in America was to essentially underwrite the American stock market, and therefore pretty much every other stock market by implication. And that has led to a rally of unbelievable magnitude from the bottom. And when the backdrop, as far as the economy is concerned, as far as a lot of people's own personal financial health is concerned, has arguably not looked as bad in living memory.
That is going to be a problem, Phil, and it's something we've spoken about before, in a sense of the rising debt, not just in the US but in the UK. And you know, you see lots of analogies of the economy is not the stock market, and vice versa. And you've got certain companies that are seriously indebted, and they're just being propped up by, you say, this sort of liquidity. But you know, it's never going to end well, this, is it?
I don't think so. I mean, it's, you know, the comment that, you know, the economy is not the stock market, or the stock market is not the economy. That is true, but company earnings, company cash flows or profits, whatever you want to call them, they are in the long run the main driver of share prices, either up or down. And the economy does have a very big say on what those profits will be. So I think there's a danger when people come out and say things like that. Not you, but you know, just the general comment that don't worry about the economy, the stock market's completely different. And I don't think that's quite true. I think that, you know, if you're looking at individual companies and, you know, what's going to make you better off in the long run is if those companies can grow their profit. And that means that you've got to have people or businesses buying what they make or provide. And if the economy is in a bad place, that's going to be a lot more difficult. So the economy does matter a lot.
Agreed. I mean, unfortunately, though, we've still got the US and Powell looking to extend debt purchases to boost what is the US economy, you know, and that's just going to, they're going to carry on doing that. Doesn't seem to be stopping at all, does it?
No, I mean, the thing is, what's underwriting stock markets and has been underwriting and propping up and driving stock markets is the fact that the saver or investor cannot get a decent rate of interest on anything else but shares, really. And it's the classic, there is no alternative, you know, or, you know, where do I put my money? And that argument and that backdrop has been there for some time, and it's there now more than ever. But what we've seen this year is you've seen a sort of flocking towards certain types of share, particularly technology shares. So it's not been a rising tide that's lifted all boats. It's been a hell of a tide that's lifted some boats, and for others it's just done the opposite. It's actually pushed them out.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, for me, one of the things that really, really intrigues me is the vast number of zero yield or even negative yield that's out there at the minute. And I think the last time I looked, it was heading towards something like 190 trillion, Phil. Now, why do countries still push that? And why are certain entities still buying negative yield when, you know, when there's other...
Doesn't make sense.
Is there no other option? That's a question I'll need to ask, I suppose, is there?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the things that, you know, makes you scratch your head.
Absolutely.
And there's no right answer to it. I mean, the argument, there's lots of reasons to explain why, is that, you know, generally speaking, when you invest, you expect to get paid. You don't expect to pay to invest. And that's what's happening with these, you know, negative yielding bonds. You're actually having to pay to lend money to the borrower. And the only reason why you would do this is that you believe that the yield will go even more negative and that the price will continue to go up and that you can actually still make money by owning these negative yielding bonds. There's also situations where, you know, where countries have negative interest rates, and that companies or people with big cash balances don't really worry about. If it's negative a quarter of a percent or something, they don't see themselves losing that much money. There is a price, or that is a price they are prepared to pay for security. And then, of course, you have, you know, pension funds, which are in some cases are mandated to have certain proportion of their investments in bonds. How you actually pay the pensions from something that doesn't produce a return is, you know, I can't answer that one. It doesn't make sense. But that has been driving the demand for government bonds. And I think, you know, the central banks have obviously played their part by being the main buyers of government bonds under this quantitative easing schemes that they've had. And I think there is no doubt that had there been no intervention from central banks, the Bank of England, European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, then interest rates on government bonds would have been through the roof in response to an economy like this, and the stock market would have been through the floor. And, you know, a lot of people, or particularly, you know, uber bears of the stock market, you know, this is the point that they make. And they, you know, they make the point that we are in some way in a false market, which a rigged market. And it's a view that I've got a lot of sympathy with the exception that I can't see what's going to change it. I think that the will, political will, it's not really political, but the sort of the will of the bankers that are backed by the politicians that employ them, will print whatever it takes in terms of fresh money to stop interest rates taking off. That doesn't mean that you can't get other problems like currency problems or inflation problems. But as far as interest rates are concerned, there is I think now, entrenched belief that they're unlikely to go up, and they're likely to stay very, very low. And therefore, people, generally speaking, are happy to put their money in the stock market.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a problem with the fact that there is so much debt everywhere, Phil, and it starts in very, very top, in the sense of the very, very large entities, which are the federal banks. And we've got a situation where almost everyone else follows suit. You know, you've got students laden with debt, you've got householders laden with debt, and now we've got essentially lots of zombie companies, which should be now extinct, laden with debt and being propped up. You know, you wrote, you know, one of the winning articles that you wrote was quality without growth is a bad mix. So on that sort of theme, looking at the companies that we've got on the stock market, could you just expand a little bit on more on that article and what it meant and what it means for companies, and why it's important to look at whether profits are sustainable for the companies that we all invest in?
Yeah, if I may, I'll take a step back and answer your previous question, which I don't think I did very well.
Okay, go ahead.
About the level of debt. And I think you're absolutely right to bring this to people's attention. And it is a serious problem. And I think the way that people look at debt is, sometimes people don't look at debt in the way that perhaps they should, in that they tend to look at only one side of debt from the borrower's perspective, and that's the interest rate. And, you know, the argument is that interest rates are low, and therefore servicing the interest payments out of wages or profits or rents or whatever, if you're a property owner, is not a problem, because interest rates are not a problem, but it's not it's not something that's going to kill you financially because interest rates are so low. What doesn't really get a lot of discussion is how people actually pay the money back. You know, I can borrow £1 million off somebody at 0%, but I've still got to pay them back £1 million. And I think where the level of why the level of debt is so serious in certainly in Western societies and even arguably in places like China now, is that debt has been used to. There's nothing wrong with debt if it's used in the right way. If you use debt to invest in a project that creates something that people need, leads to economic growth, leads to profits, provides jobs. In other words, you get a return on that debt. Then debt is not a problem, as long as the return on the amount of money that you invest is more than the interest rate that you're paying. The problem, I think, in a lot of Western society, particularly this country and the United States, is that debt has been essentially used for consumption, for buying stuff, not for investing. And governments have been doing that as well. And we go back to a deep-rooted problem that in this country probably been existing for the last 15, 20 years, and in America for the last maybe even 50 years, in that the buying power of people's wages has not been growing. So that weekly pay packet that people get has been buying fewer goods and services than it did in the past because it's not been keeping up with prices. And workers have been getting a smaller slice of the pie. And companies and certain people within those companies have been getting a bigger slice of the pie. And you get things like inequality, which is a big social issue. Now, addressing that to the growth issue of companies is that essentially a company in the long run can only sell more stuff if its customers have got more money. And what's essentially been happening for some consumer goods is that people haven't had the money to buy these goods outright. And so they buy these goods on credit. And you see it in cars, mobile phones, computers, obviously housing, which has been going on for a long time, but sort of smaller and smaller sort of consumer outlays are now driven by credit. And even when interest rates are low, the ability of people that are not getting a pay rise in real terms, or may even be losing their jobs, their ability to buy more stuff of what companies make, it gets more difficult. So when you look at a company, you have to be looking at who the customers are. What is the ability of the customers of a company to keep on buying more stuff? And I'll give you an example of like the technology companies. So one of the reasons that technology companies have done so well is because their customers, largely businesses, who have been doing quite well, some of them very well, they've been taking a bigger slice of the cake. They've got money to spend. So they've got money to spend on things like software, cloud computing, and that kind of thing. And then, you see those trends develop during the year with home working and all that kind of thing. And that's kind of an explanation as to why some of these companies have done well, because their customers are healthy. But then you sort of look at other businesses where it's not the case. So, you come into the UK and you look at things like restaurants and pubs, which have been struggling for years. And that's a kind of sort of roundabout view of what you have to look at, just to sort of getting behind the basics of thinking, what does this company do? Who are its customers? can it sell more? Because what I think one of the biggest lessons you learn, or I've learned through doing this for what, nearly 25 years, is when you're looking at stocks and investments, you can talk about all kinds of different things. Like, you know, a lot of people look at valuation, look at cheap stocks, but you keep coming back, or I keep coming back to this one thing, in that really, if you're looking for an investment that's going to make you better off, that's going to grow the values of your savings over the years, yes, the price you pay for it is not something that you should ignore, even though sometimes it feels like that in 2020. But unless you've got a company that can grow its profits, you're going to struggle. You're going to struggle. You're going to have to rely on getting lucky with it being bought out, or it merging with somebody else, and relying on costs. So it is the ability of the company to sell more. So you're looking at revenues, turnover, or sales, however you want to look at it. And that is probably the most important thing of trying to work out whether you've got a company that's going to do well for you.
I think that goes back to the discussions we've had quite a few times, Phil, about the fact that some stocks are simply cheap for good reason. You know, if they're cyclical, if they're in debt, if they're in a low margin sort of environment where, you know, that whatever they're buying now, the costs are going up, so therefore the profits can't actually grow. But people see them at 52 weeks low, or whatever sort of, you know, phase they're in of the chart of their share price, and the share price hasn't gone anywhere for a year. So people think, oh, it must be a bargain now, because it was at a pound before and now it's at 20 pence, therefore I'm going to buy it. And there's far more in the detail that people simply are missing here, and it could be a long time before they recover, if they do at all.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is what is referred to, you know, in investing circles as value traps.
Indeed.
So you look at a company that is cheap, but you fail to recognize or identify that there's a good reason why it's cheap. I always sort of do the analogy of like bottles of wine in the supermarket. You know, you might go and find a bottle of wine that costs £4 or £5 or even less. And occasionally you'll get lucky and it'll taste really nice. More often than not, you'll take a sip of it and you might either put it in the cooking pot or put it down the sink. And this is the same sort of thing with shares, is that there are businesses that are struggling, and the stock market very rarely gives away free lunches. It does give away free lunches, but not generally lots of them. And you have to be wary of, you know, a business that is struggling. Unless you can identify a catalyst for that to change, so you might have a new management team coming in, or a new product, or a, you know, a general turnaround plan, or the industry is improving, you have to be able to identify something that will cause the profits to go up and cause more investors to look on that stock more favorably, buy the shares and push it up. That's one instance. The other instance where I see a lot of investors making mistakes, and let's face it, we all make mistakes.
We all do, Phil, every day.
Is when they look at a company that is what's well known as a cyclical company, where the sales and the profits move up and down in line with the general economy. And quite often the stock market will look at a company that's currently doing very well, or has been doing well for a number of years, but history teaches it that it won't continue to do well. So its share price can be quite subdued while its profits are quite high. And therefore, the valuation of its share price, the comparison of its share price with its profits, gives you a low valuation, a low price to profits or price to earnings ratio. But actually, the stock market can be right. The company, and you know, the company's been growing. So you get people who might say, hey, look at this. This company's been growing really strongly and it's on a really cheap valuation. You've got to buy some of this. And you'll get a situation where eventually the company will come out and say, revenues have peaked, they're not going up. Our major customer has not ordered as much stuff this year and profits are going down. And the share price will go down. And you're left thinking, you're thinking you bought something that's cheap and you receive, you're on the receiving end of a very humbling experience of not having really understood what you were buying.
I think we've seen that, Phil, in the sense of maybe, you know, last year, a lot of people were talking up the likes of Fevertree. You did a fantastic article on Aston Martin. You know, we saw people talking about, you know, the reasons why they should be buying into even AA at one stage. And all those commentators have gone reasonably quiet now and no longer talking up those stocks. And you've talked about debt and the consumers. And there was a time when even Pendragon was being talked about as a really good growth stock. And that's on its knees because the consumers simply aren't going out buying as many cars and taking on as much debt, you know, unless they're very wealthy.
Yeah, you get momentum behind certain shares. And you know, you mentioned Fevertree. Fevertree is a very, very good business. It's been very successful. And I think just one of the issues, you know, the main issue with Fevertree, I think, you know, Fevertree shares, I mean, what are they now? About 21, 22 pounds, something like that. And not so long ago, they were, you know, they were nearly 40 pounds, or they were 40 pounds. And I think the problem you get is you get a company that does very well for a period of time, and the share price increases a lot faster than its profits. And you get one of the things that I think it's very, very important for the investor to try and get a hold of is what the share price is implying. You know, we can't predict the future, but what we do have is that the investor has two very valuable pieces of information at all times for a quoted share. They have the current level of profits and they have the share price and the value of the business. And without getting too technical, there are shortcuts and detailed ways that you can have a stab at working what's implied about the future. And in very, very simple terms, a high valuation of a company, so a high share price relative to the profits per share, high PE is what people talk about, that means the expectations are there of high growth. Now, sometimes those expectations are correct, and the company keeps coming out and saying, actually, we're going to make more money than we think, when we thought we were going to make, and the share price keeps going up. But eventually it gets to a level, or tends to get to a level, where it can't keep going up. It comes up against, you know, tough comparative performances. And the share price gets driven by this expectation that profits will always keep, expectations of profits will always keep going up. And sometimes that can go on for years and you can make huge amounts of money. But sooner or later, you tend to get a turning point and you're left holding a share with very, very high expectations that are baked in that can't be met. And the stock market is littered with examples of that. And actually, there's a lot to be said for sort of like the tortoise and hare approach to investing, where if you are nimble and savvy and a little bit lucky, you can make huge profits trading these companies that where expectations are getting better. Or the alternative is you can buy companies that can chug away, grow at a lower rate, but keep on growing for years and years and years and make money that way. But yeah, it's if you look at the shares that people think that are cheap or hot, then if you've got more than a sort of, you know, few weeks or few month time horizon, then you've got to consider many more things rather than the short-term direction of the share price, and it's not easy.
Agreed on that front, Phil. I wanted to ask you on that note, of any examples that you could give for our listeners regarding the stocks that aren't hot but are consistently just chugging away, doing what they need to do, and are not really talked about. Because my concern a lot of times when I'm talking regarding the podcast that I do, the Twin Peaks podcast, is that a lot of people are not doing enough research. They're jumping on the bandwagon of stocks which are momentum stocks that are going up, but not really doing enough research as to how long of a tailwind they've actually got, you know. And like, as you've just said, you know, within 3 months or 6 months, the share price could be lower than where they actually purchased it at, and they're left holding the baby as such.
God, that's a nasty question you asked me there, because that's what everyone's looking for all the time. I mean, I think the problem you've got is that if you're looking at the bigger end of the stock market, you know, the FTSE 100, FTSE 350, there's a lot. It's very difficult to get an information edge, and the companies that are doing very well tend to be priced accordingly. They tend to come with very, very high price tags on their shares. So, and then if you go down the lower end, you know, you go into the sort of smaller end of the market, yes, you're probably going to have a better chance of finding things that have been underappreciated or overlooked, but you arguably put yourself in a more risky position in doing so, in that you're dealing with shares that are not easy to, they can be easy to buy, they can be very hard to sell, and if you get it wrong, you take a lot of pain. But if you are looking to, you should always research companies. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that people don't do enough research when they're pursuing a strategy of investing in individual shares, and they only really sort of scratch the surface in researching, and therefore arguably don't understand what it does. That's not to say that there aren't some fabulous private investors out there who really, really do their research. And I look at some people on Twitter and I think, yeah, you know, you're doing a really good job here, you know, in terms of trying to understand the company. The danger with that approach is that the more you know, the more overconfident you can become. So there isn't a direct trade-off between knowledge and success. Knowledge is a good thing, but it doesn't mean that you have an edge. It just means that you understand the business and you understand the risks and rewards perhaps better than other people do. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make money. Doesn't mean that you're not going to lose money. But the research of smaller companies is where people who are listening, you know, individual investors who are listening to this podcast are going to probably get a better bang for their buck. But I think that research in general, everyone should research. And I think one of the things that I keep banging out on about a lot is that there's far too much emphasis placed on how good things can be, and not enough emphasis placed on understanding the risks of the company, the business, the industry that a company is operating in. And that's where I think a lot of investors, professional and private, come a cropper.
I've got two questions to ask on that note, Phil. One is regarding this the point that you made about research, in a sense of how much research is enough, and is it ever enough, or can you do too much? And then the second aspect of it is looking at the companies and the clustering. There seems to be a clustering. It seems to be almost as if, yes, there's momentum in that stock, but it's almost like X, Y, and Z have bought this stock, so therefore almost everyone else on a momentum basis is buying into that stock. Why does that keep recurring?
Yeah. What was the first one again?
Sorry. The first one about how much research is enough, because that thing where people say analysis paralysis sort of thing, you can almost research a stock too much and you get a bias on it.
Sorry. I had this discussion the other day, actually. I interviewed Stephen Clapham, who's just brought out a new book, which is a really good book, actually. It's called The Smart Money Method, and it's all about researching companies. And in his in the first few pages of this book, he goes on about the 80-20 principle, which basically means with 20% of the effort, you can get 80% of the outcome that you want. And I think that stock research, company research, that applies very, very well. And I think you can spend inordinate amounts of time on researching companies and get very little reward back. So you can overanalyze companies. You can kid yourself that, you know, and by spending hours and hours and hours, that you are going to somehow find a nugget that no one else has found. You're going to uncover it, and you're going to discover the path to riches. That may happen from time to time, but very, 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 very rarely. And I think that what's most important is to just set out some basic questions about a company. And, you know, you could even do this as like a little as sort of, you know, a handful of key questions about a company. And if you can answer those key questions, then you can build yourself a pretty good understanding of whether the company is potentially a good investment or not. And, you know, never be afraid to ask really simple questions. And, you know, it's amazing, you know, you can have a discussion and I've come across this myself, and I think I've looked at companies and I've put my hands up and think, actually, I don't really understand what this company does. And sometimes I will never understand what a company does, even spending a lot of time looking at it. And if I don't understand what a company does, if I can't explain it to a mate down the pub, then I probably shouldn't be investing in the shares. So first and foremost, understanding what a company does, ask why that company exists. If this company didn't exist, would anybody be bothered about it? So does this company provide something that people need? Is it a problem solver? Is it an enabler of something? And then you start digging deeper and things like, you know, what does this company do that, you know, perhaps other companies don't do? Because if you're dealing with a company that does things that lots of other companies do, say, for example, like supermarkets, then it's unlikely that you're going to find a company that's going to make lots of money and grow very quickly. And so you also then need to focus about growth. You know, how does this thing grow? Can it sell more to more customers, existing customers? Can it go into new markets? Can it develop new products? Can it defend what it's got? You know, who's trying to eat this company's lunch? So you spend a lot of time understanding the competitive positioning of a company. And then the other thing that I think is incredibly valuable, and one of the reasons I said at the start of this conversation about how valuable 2020 has been, is because one of the things that's been really successful for investors, certainly since the financial crisis, is buying, and probably before that, is buying companies that are very resilient in a recession, where their profits don't collapse. And it's part of this thing called low volatility investing. You know, you look at companies that have very resilient earnings, because earnings drive share prices. And one of the things that most people who have been investing for a long period of time will know, that if you have a stock in your portfolio that makes a big, big loss, it can be very, very hard to recover from that loss. So, you know, a classic example is that a share price that halves has to double again to get back to where you were. So the best thing to do is to avoid trying to own those kind of shares in the first place. Indeed. And one of the best ways to avoid those kind of shares is to avoid businesses that do bad in a recession. And hence, you will have learnt in 2020, arguably more so than in 2008, 2009, which companies do badly in a recession. And that's very useful going forward. And then obviously things like the price that you pay. And it seems like the price that you've paid sometimes doesn't matter when you look at some of these tech stocks, but generally in the long run, it does matter. So that's a sort of shortcut into the kind of things that you can look at when you're researching. And that needn't take hours and hours and hours. But generally speaking, when you own a company, you always keep learning about it. Every announcement, every set of results that comes out, generally you'll find something that enhances your knowledge. So you never stop learning. And that commitment to learning is ongoing and is very valuable.
Agreed.
Get on to your second bit about clustering. Yeah, I mean, it does seem that if you were to spend some time looking around bulletin boards and Twitter and that kind of thing, that you will find lots of people that own the same thing. And I don't think there's any coincidence in that. I think sometimes that will be, there'll be very good reasons for that, you know, that it's a good company. Other reasons are, you know, less clear cut. I think that there are elements of social media, shall we say, that plays certain sections of the stock market quite well. And you can get people that get a following, and they'll buy a certain stock, and people will just copy them, and the share price goes up, which sort of leads to a virtual circle of, well, you know, it enhances the reputation of the person that suggested the share, and it goes on. Now sometimes that's fine. It does concern me particularly for inexperienced investors, that some of these shares that where you get this kind of clustering are quite risky, in that they are small shares, small company shares, very illiquid shares, and it can be very difficult to get out of these shares if the good news that people hope for doesn't turn up. So there are good and bad reasons for clustering. You know, it's not difficult for a lot of people to look at the information. I mean, a lot of us are looking at the same information. You know, we've got the same stocks. We're looking at, if you're looking at UK stocks, then there's lots of people out there who've got the information to look at lots of things. And it's not, you know, it's not totally unexpected that quite a few people can come to the same view about a stock, whether it's good or bad. So certainly in the sort of bigger size of the market, that's more of a case. I think in the smaller end of the market, when you get clustering, that's when it's, you know, you got to be a bit careful, because you can look at some of these shares that are being touted, and some of them don't even make any money. And so they may have a great story. And, you know, one of the themes of 2020 and recent years is, you know, it's hammered home to you is that investors or stock market participants, because I don't think all of them are investors. Some of them are traders and speculators. They love a story, and stories drive share prices, and not just in small company shares. You know, a lot of the story in tech, you know, on the NASDAQ is what's been driving, you know, big cap technology shares, massive mega cap, multi, some of them trillion dollar companies. So I think you've always got to be wary and look at the kind of company that is being pushed. And I think be very wary that, you know, people are talking their own book a lot. They are essentially are trying to use parts of social media to make themselves better off. Thankfully, I don't see that as a big part of big problem. I do see it as a problem, because I see inexperienced participants being forced to take into big risks, which is something I'd rather not see, because I think that it leads people to lose money. And it's something that is not particularly, doesn't particularly sit easily with how I sort of, you know, view the world of investing. But I think generally speaking, most of what you see is pretty good. I mean, I think there's a lot of very good people out there who will share ideas and will exchange views and get into dialogues. And that is immensely, immensely valuable. And I would say that, you know, that accounts for a lot of people, certainly on my Twitter feed. And, you know, you and I would not be having this conversation if it wasn't for Twitter. So it's generally a force for good. I've seen things this year, which, I mean, at the risk of getting a lot of stick for saying this, you just see things and think, come on, you know, that's just a blatant bit of ramping, you know. And you just think you don't need to do that. You know, my view is, if you are right about a company, and that you have picked a company that has good products, good markets, that is managed well, you don't need to ramp it, because the company will come through with higher profits, and the share price will look after itself. So my view is that, you know, you can get a lot of companies talking very, you know, a lot of people talking about, you know, really good companies. You know, and Games Workshop is a great example. That is a company that has delivered. It is a company that is making something that very few companies and competitors make, and it's doing it really well. Its profits are going up, and its share price has largely followed suit. May get out of kilter with it from time to time, but you know, generally the trend is the share price and the profits have been on the same direction of travel. I think you just got to be careful when, if you're new to this game and you see somebody that's got a lot of followers who is touting a company that doesn't make any money, and it's not difficult to go and find out whether the company is making any money. And it may well go on to make money, but if it hasn't made money for a long period of time, you just ask a simple question. You know, if you're looking at a company that's not making any money, then perhaps you need to be a little bit careful here.
I completely agree with you, Phil. It goes back to the old principle of traders and speculators are playing a completely different game to you and I, who are investors, and it's almost as if they're playing the greater fool formula theory, you know. And there are times when, you know, companies that aren't profitable do extremely well, and you have got a cohort of people that are bearish, you know, in the opposite sense of all the bulls are out there, that are bearish on a company, and that company still goes on to do well for a variety of different reasons. And we've saw that and have been seeing that for the past couple of years. And, you know, all the bears that have been attacking, prime example in the US, Tesla. And looking at the chart right now, and Tesla's up year to date 730%. And as far as I'm aware, the last thing I checked, they're still not profitable, Phil. Yeah? And it's valued at what's it valued at now? 660 million? 60 billion, sorry?
I don't think I'm wrong in saying this, but I'll just caveat. I think the market value of Tesla is worth more than all the quoted car manufacturers in the world combined.
I think you're right. I think I put a tweet out about it last week. Yeah, I think you're correct.
Yeah. So it's worth more than, you know, Volkswagen, Toyota, General Motors, Fords, and so on combined.
Yep.
And yeah. It's a mystery. But it's I think there's no doubt that a lot of the gain in Tesla has been the bears giving up. You know, it was there were so many bets against Tesla. And, you know, when you bet against a company's shares going down and they start going up, it's your losses are, there's no limit on how much money you can lose. And that gets to a situation where you can't take any more pain and you have to sort of, what's known as cover your position and buy the shares back that you've sold, and that's driven the share price of Tesla. You know, it's essentially been a rocket fuel under the share price. I mean, there has been signs that the profitability and the position of the company could be getting better. And then you always get this debate, don't you, that, you know, is Tesla a car company or is it a technology company? Because it has the sort of the battery technology, which can be used in things like solar, that people point to. For me, and I have to say, I haven't studied Tesla in great depth. Man, you know, I just see it as a car company, you know. And car companies generally haven't made very good long-term investments. And yeah, I don't know how you can get to, you know, the kind of profits that you would need to justify the valuation of the stock market has put on Tesla. But it's a story. You know, it's a very compelling story about technology, about enablers, about, you know, electric vehicles and how the world will change and how Tesla will enable that change. And that's a very powerful story that a lot of people have bought into. It's not the kind of thing that I could ever buy. But it just shows you what can happen.
It's very powerful indeed, Phil, because, you know, if you look at how many cars they've sold, each car is probably valued now, it's what, a couple of million each to what the market cap is. So that's pretty staggering. But going back to, is it a car company or a technology company? You've written quite a few times on Ocado, you know, and the argument has been, you know, it should be on a some people have written it should be on a multiple as to it being a retailer, and then other people saying, well, it should be on a multiple to being a tech company. And at some point or other, you know, people have decided that actually it's a tech company, it's not a retailer, because it can't make any money on selling its own retail stuff. So that's a major issue that people have with finding a valuation for Ocado.
Yeah. I fully admit that I don't get Ocado. I think if Ocado shares were, you know, a quarter of what they were, I'd probably, you know, a lot of it is not just about the business, it's about the price that the stock market puts on a business. And I think where I and lots of others with the likes of Tesla and Ocado is that you think, okay, you know, I get what they're doing. You know, I get the product. I look at what it's trying to achieve with the product. But the price tag that's put on it, I don't get. I mean, you know, Ocado is a great example in that, you know, it is, there's no doubt in my mind that its warehouses and robots and software that pick people's shopping is very clever, very efficient, and does the job better than people scurrying around trolleys in supermarkets picking shopping for other people. Where I sort of struggle with online retail as a whole, which is, you know, there's no doubt it's a growth trend, but the problem that Ocado and everybody else needs to solve is not the picking, it's the delivery, and it's the cost of, you know, of getting the weekly shopping from a warehouse or a supermarket to people's front doors. That's where a lot of the cost is, and where a lot of the profit isn't. And so Ocado can solve part of it, but, you know, once those goods have been packed and put into a van, there's still the driver's wages, the petrol, the insurance, the depreciation on the vans, and, you know, things like traffic congestion, managing your route, moving around all over the place, and getting a sufficient number of people to do that to make a lot of profit. And Ocado's had a very good year because of lockdown, but is still not making, for me, you know, I think it's making about 2 billion of sales in the UK from its retail business. And then it uses a profit measure called EBITDA, which is profits before interest, tax, depreciation, and something called amortization, which is used to spread the cost of things like brands and software and that kind of thing. And it's going to make about 70 million pounds of that form of profit. But if you take away the costs of replacing the vans and software and the fact that these robots won't last forever, then it's still making, in my opinion, very little money. And it's had a fantastic year where it's been able to, you know, its warehouses have been, you know, running at high capacity, which is one of the things that, you know, if your factories or warehouses are busy, it's called, you know, they're what's known as well loaded. And so that when they're well loaded, they can cover a lot of costs, fixed costs.
Yeah.
And that's how you can drive profit. But for me, this is part of the problem with Ocado, in that Ocado is selling a technology. These customer fulfillment centers or warehouse and robots and software and picking software. And it doesn't really solve the problem of internet retail, internet grocery retail, in that internet grocery retail, as far as I'm concerned, no one's making meaningful money out of it. And yeah, you can talk about, you know, eventually it might go into non-food retail, but you know, I see companies like ASOS and Boohoo going into things like automated warehouses. They're not buying Ocado software, they're buying somebody else's, or they're doing it themselves. And this is the issue I have with Ocado. Ocado will make money selling its technology to Kroger in the US or Casino in France. And if you actually go into the annual report, they'll tell you how much money they expect to make. And then you can take that money, and then you can take what's happening with the UK retailers, and then you can look at the value of the business on the stock market. And there's a massive gap between a sensible valuation you'd put on a UK internet grocery business, the future profits from contracts from other retailers to buy the tech, and what the shares are priced at. And so that's really my issue. I totally get the tech, but I think you have to be careful when and I saw this, you know, in the internet bubble of the 90s and the early 2000s. Just because a company is tagged with a label or a sector, you know, it doesn't mean that a pound of its earnings is worth more than a pound of earnings that's coming from a pub. You know, a pound of future earnings is a pound of future earnings. Now, if that pound of earnings can grow faster, then yes, you can have a higher valuation attached to it. But just because it's a tech company doesn't mean that it's automatically worth a fortune.
Phil, you're spot on, and this goes back to your discussions that you've had in the past about the importance of looking at organic sales and like for like growth. And sometimes people just miss that, and all they see is, oh, it's in AI, it's in tech, and therefore it's got to have this high PE. And its PE is actually lower than that other company in that particular sector. So therefore, it's going to have to get up to that level. And sometimes it doesn't, because it doesn't have the growth. It simply doesn't have the growth.
This is it. And the thing is, you don't know. You don't know if it's going to have the growth. Now, you will get some of these companies will be winners. You know, but you know, everyone can look back with hindsight and say, "Oh, you know, if you bought Amazon 20 years ago, or
yeah,
you know, Google bought YouTube for a steal, you know, and that kind of thing." But it's a completely different problem to solve when you haven't got that 2020 backwards vision, and. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult to, certainly hard for me to kind of rationalize this, because I totally accept that there are people who are very, very good at identifying themes and, you know, picking businesses that have done very well.
Okay.
But I don't know whether that makes them investors or just very clever speculators.
Well, I mean, emerging tech, future tech, we can all see, you know, and we can see what our children are doing regarding tech. And, you know, I'm like you, Phil. I love my book. I like to hold a book, but everything else is being consumed online now. You know, my daughter, when she was 6, 7, 8, she loved books. And now she wants to consume everything online, you know. So everything's going that way, and you know we're being forced down. You know we're in the lockdown, and Brexit's impacting us, and we're going to have to go and do our shopping online. You know, everyone's making purchases more and more and more and more online now. It's been the biggest boost that retail has had in I don't know how many years, but it's still probably not going to be enough once the lockdown finishes. And the question is, how many people are going to go revert back to actually driving to the supermarket? I don't know if as many will.
This is it. We don't know. But you see, the other side of it is that whilst there's been, you know, a massive increase in demand, that's not come for free for the companies that are producing it. So they've had to put, you know, extra staff, extra vehicles. And this is where you sort of get into the basics of going back to the basics and trying to understand, you know, not only if a company can grow, but what does it cost to grow? And, you know, there's a big difference between, say, something like a retailer, which has to put costs to grow, than they say someone like a software company, where they spend money developing a piece of software, and the cost of selling an extra piece of software is nothing, virtually next to nothing now, and it's downloaded over the internet. Which kind of company would you rather own? Would you rather own a software company with growth or a retailer with growth? I know which one that I would rather own.
Agreed. Yeah. So that touches on a very important point, which I think some people don't look at often enough, Phil, and that's the return on invested capital. What sort of percentage would you say is above the threshold that people should be looking at, Phil, rather than, you know, 1% or 5%? What do you think they should be looking at regarding that percentage?
Return on money invested is what I prefer to call it. I like the word money rather than capital. I'm not having a go, Pete. Bugbears of mine. It's very difficult. There's two. It's like anything. It depends. Okay. I mean, I say look for companies that make 15% return. So that's looking at their operating profit as a percentage of the money they've invested. But that doesn't mean that if you come across a company that doesn't make that or makes lower than that, that you should just throw it in the waste paper basket or just discard it. Because there are companies that are growing, that are investing up front, which can depress their return. But in 3, 4, 5 years' time, they could be making huge amounts of money. So it's not just companies that are making that return now, but you also got to look to the possibility that actually it's not making great money now, but I can see what's happening here. It's investing in this new project or a bit of software or what have you. And that actually, if that comes through and people start buying that, this company will be very profitable. Now, that's quite involved kind of analysis. But when you sort of, going back to one of the previous questions that you asked about, you know, how do people look for and find winning investments? The problem with an approach of saying I'm only going to buy, you know, high return on investments, you know, it's not that difficult to calculate that number. People have got screening software and they can find these companies. Where it's interesting is finding the company that's not there, that's going to be there.
Agreed.
And so if you look at a company that is, so you might get a company that's just moved into profit and actually its profits can start getting a lot bigger. Now, providing the share price hasn't got carried away, these are the kind of things that you can see. Or you can see a company which has gone through a hard time, has got a new management team in, or it's getting rid of, you know, problem businesses which have dragged the return down. And once they've got rid of, the return goes up again. So it's not essentially what the return figure is, it's what it will be. And obviously, you know, if you've got a business that's already good and you think it can stay good and it can keep getting better, then that can be a good investment, but so can the investment that's on its way up.
Okie dokie. No, thank you for those, Phil. I wanted to round off our discussion, Phil, with a viewpoint from you, in a sense of, given the tumultuous year we've had, we're currently still negotiating Brexit. We've got lockdown and tier four in London, and you've spoken about resilience. What are you seeing, and what would you like to see, in a sense of companies' outlooks regarding what you foresee for 2021, in a sense of what's out there that you think, actually, these companies which I've looked at are resilient, or these are the type of companies that could be resilient under these difficult circumstances in 2021 for people to look at, potentially research going forward?
Cool, that's a stinker. I mean, in some ways, I mean, the answer is, I don't know. No, nobody knows. I think after this year, you know, for anyone to come out and say that they know what's going to happen after a year like this is, you know, it's difficult.
That's a very difficult. Yeah.
It's,
you know, let me rephrase it then. Given given what you've seen in 2020, which for you in your research eyes have been the most resilient companies, and do you see them potentially being as resilient in 2021?
Short answer to that question is, I think companies that have been resilient in a market like this and an economy like this will probably continue to be resilient. So companies that sell, you know, essential things that have been plugged into the stay-at-home economy. So some of the gaming companies, some of the, you know, consumer staples companies, software companies, where their businesses have not been affected by COVID so much. I think that, you know, those kind of companies have, you know, I struggle to see how their businesses will suddenly go into reverse. There is a possibility that some companies, you know, we talked about Ocado, have received a one-off windfall, or a sustained one-off windfall from people staying at home, spending a bit more money, that once people start going back out again, and this is it, no one knows, you know, we're talking here on, you know, 21st of December, when you've gone into another lockdown in where I live, southeast of England, and nobody knows when you're going to come out of it. So predicting when those level of demands or consumer patterns normalize, if they ever do, is difficult. But there are companies that have certainly benefited from the trends that we've seen and the behavior that we've seen. I think what's more interesting, slightly skirting around your question, is whether the share prices of these businesses will continue to do well. We could have a situation where these businesses do continue to do well, but they don't do better than people expected, and actually they end up having quite a tough year in share price terms. And you know, you can say the same for, you know, recovery shares, you know, shares that have recovered. You know, I look at some of the travel related stocks. So I look at, you know, things like Jet2, WH Smith, which have come back a lot from, you know, very, very depressed levels in the spring. And it's, you think, okay, if we get a situation where hopefully people start going on holiday again, they start taking flights and they start buying stuff again, how much of that's already priced in? Not as much, not as much as I'm talking to you now as it was on Friday afternoon, but you know, that's the kind of stuff that you have to answer. And it's, and I, you know, I've seen and read what other people have said, that you could actually have a situation where the economies of the world, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, you know, the vaccine, more people get vaccinated. We get a situation where lockdowns and restrictions can be relaxed, and we get some kind of return to normality. And you can paint a picture where the economy comes back really quite strongly, but the stock market actually doesn't go anywhere and may even go down. That thought has, you know, crossed many people's minds who are, you know, gazing into their crystal balls at this time of year. So short answer is, I don't know. I think
that reply and the humility and the honesty of it, Phil. I mean, obviously, a lot of people were talking about, you know, and expecting a Santa rally. And right up until Friday, as you say, they were thinking, oh, this is it now, it's starting. And then, you know, the news that we had on Friday evening was one that no one wanted to hear. And, you know, lots of people's Christmases have been ruined. But I think this thing about seasonality and people's expectations are always quite rose-tinted when it comes to this time of year. And I'm not saying that there won't still be a little bit of a mini rally, but the likelihood is that there probably isn't going to be. And you've got to plan further than, you know, a season. You've got to plan for, if you're investing, as you've always said, to be invested for the long term, you know, and lower the risk, but, you know, have the expectations that you're going to be invested in the market for beyond 5 years and much longer than that to be a success.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, the answer to a lot of these questions is it depends. You know, if you are an investor that invests in funds or tracker funds that track the market, then the direction of the market is always important, because often, you know, the trend will affect virtually every company out there to a certain degree. But if you are, you know, and a lot of listeners to this podcast will be investors in individual shares, some ways you just don't even really want to think about what's going to happen to the market. You just when you're investing in individual companies, that's not what you think about. You look at the businesses, and you look at the prospects for businesses, and you know, it doesn't really matter what, you know, where we are, whether it's New Year's Eve or whatever, or the 5th of July. You just take the same approach, and you focus on businesses. And I think if you are an individual investor in individual shares, then focusing on businesses is how you get better at this. And it's advice that will apply regardless of what the economy is.
That's a brilliant sentiment to end this Conker's Corner interview on, Phil. I want to thank you ever so much for doing this interview with me again, Phil. And again, just cheer and congratulate you on the CFA UK Journalism Award for 2020, which I know you don't like to talk about. So I'm just going to shout it from the rooftops again. And continued success of the Alpha Report with John Newman with Investors Chronicle. And hopefully, if any of you ladies and gents are listening out there and you still haven't gone out and purchased Phil's book, it's called How to Pick Quality Shares, A Three-Step Process of Selecting Profitable Stocks. A fantastic book, which I would recommend to anybody who's interested in investing in stocks and shares. Thank you ever so much, Phil.
My pleasure, Pete. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, it's been an absolute delight having you on again. We might have to do it as an annual event and see you again this time next year.
Yeah, that's happy to do that.
All right then, mate. Thank you ever so much, Phil. Take care. God bless. And I hope your family and everybody is well. And stay safe, my good friend.
Thank you, and to you and yours.